Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 25-26 Summer Mescun, a mix of literary happenings. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing a potpourri of subjects and authors of historical fiction. There'll be some recent novel launches and a couple of wild cards. So, lay back in the sun, slap on the tanning butter, sip on something long and cool and laced with mint, and listen to your summer fling. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. In early December 2025, Shelley Dark was in conversation about her second novel, Son of Hydra, with book coach Hayley Saunders at the Noosa Library.
Thank you, everyone, and thanks, Rachel and the team at Noosa Library for inviting you to interview, Amazon best-selling author, Shelley Dark. So we're here to celebrate the launch of Son of Hydra, which is Shelley's latest. Do you call it a novel?
Yes, a novel.
Great. So let's start for those who haven't read it yet, room for an absolute treat, but can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Well, to start with, John didn't, and my husband John didn't have any idea that he was related in any way to anyone great until our son came home from a trip to the Snowy Mountains and he said at dinner one night, "Dad, are we Greek?" And John said, "Well, not that I know of." And that really started it for me. I did what anyone would do when they find out they're married to the great-great-grandson of a pirate. I was astounded. But B, I thought, I've got to find out more about this man. Was he a criminal? You know, it's got the romance of the Pirates of the Caribbean, and yet it's got the whiff of violence and criminality. And that really interested me. I thought, what was it? Well, who was he really? And because whoever he was, you know, I'm married to his great-great-grandson. And so that was what sent me first on a search for who he was. At that stage, I wasn't remotely thinking I'd write a book. That never been anything I considered doing at that stage, because it was about 20 years ago that we learnt about it. That life went on in the farm and the internet didn't really exist. And when it came, it was so slow, you couldn't, you know, look anything up. But eventually, when we did get internet and it was fast enough to do something, I looked on the Monero Pioneers website, which was where he settled eventually, this pirate. And it was really helpful to me, as in the basic bones of the story. And the more I knew, the more I wanted to know, the more questions it raised. And so then someone told me about a book called Greek Australians, written by a fellow who was the Greek ambassador to Athens, an Australian guy called Hugh Gilchrist. And he wrote a book called Greek Australians. And there were two chapters devoted entirely to these seven Greek pirates who arrived in Australia. So I set for that book, I bought in a line and it came. That was really exciting because they've started to put some flesh on the bones of the basic story that I'd learnt. And I'm not sure at what stage it was, Hayley, that I started to think, this really is the stuff of noise. This is the most remarkable story, you know, and fairly well apart from within the Greek community, where he is a bit of a soap hero. But in the broader Australian community, I mean, our perception is the Greek migration started post-World War II. And I just thought, I need to bring this fellow back. Weevil needs to be, I'd like him to be an Australian folk hero because I think he deserves it.
Yeah, for sure. John is near up back. So if you want to see what the descendant of a real high Dusban Kui Di Bas Aspizatal. So tell us Geeka's story. How did you become a pirate and what happened to it?
Now, when you say how did he become a pirate, there's a lot that you can't find out with a story like this. So, you know, to begin with, all I knew was that he was a pirate. He was arrested off the coast of Africa. They were tried in Malta, and then they ended up here as convicts, and he became the shepherd and worked for the Ryrid family of Braybrook. So that was about the extent of what I knew. But the intriguing part of the story that Hugh Gilchrist mentioned was that on his death certificate, it'd see his father was a gentleman of Ytra. And Hugh Gilchrist said that was shorthand for ship owner. There were three classes on the island. There were the ship owners, vastly wealthy. They made their money during the Napoleonic Wars, running Russian wheat to Napoleon's troops in contravention of the British blockade. He was trying to starve Napoleon out. And so they'd become, and they were very good shipbuilders too, and obviously very good sailors. Where was I up to? I lost my demac. Who was he? Yeah, so what's I going to tell you about here?
His father on the BGF.
Yes, that's right. His father was a gentleman of Ytra. Sorry, I lost the plot there. That captures all it. So his father was a gentleman of Ytra, which suggested he came from a very rich family. So I knew that much. But to put together the actual story, I knew that there were nine boys. All the proverbial literature said there were nine boys on this ship, but they were off the coast of Africa when they were arrested, and that's a long way from Ytra, which suggests that a little of proficiency in sailing that was out of the usual. I mean, most piracy was happening in the islands and in the Aegean Sea, not necessarily as far away as that, but they attacked a multi-ship, and Malta at that time was British, and Britain was controlling the Mediterranean, trying to stop this piracy of their shipping, and so they were throwing their weight around. But in one way, I was lucky because that meant that the records were kept by the British, and when I went to Malta, so then I was able to find the excellent record keeping, which, you know, because there were no records on Ytra of these boys. When I went to the archives, they filtered up on the internet for me and gave me the information, you know, that I'd had for 4 years. And so they didn't know everything about them, which to my mind was strange because it was thought they were freedom fighters. They were attacking a ship that was supplying Alexandria, and Egypt and Turkey were the enemy. The Turks were the Ottoman Empire, who had subjugated the Greeks for centuries, and they had teamed up with the Egyptians. So that was who the Greeks were fighting. And the Greek navy consisted of the ships belonging to three islands. That was it. It was Ytra and Sara and Betsy's. So if Ytra had 150 ships, all privately owned, all owned by individual men, but these fellows gave their ships to the war effort, and then the sailors of Ytra were expected to fight on those ships. And so these boys were arrested off the coast of Africa, having attacked a Maltese ship. And so that was about all I knew at that stage, that they'd been tried in Malta as pirates and they'd been convicted and ended up here.
What do you think it was about Geeka that captured your heart and made you start to do all this research apart from the family connection? What prompted that?
I think it was when I found out that he was the son of a ship owner, because I did find that out eventually. It was confirmed. It was the notion that somebody who had been born to this enormous wealth, and it was amazing. Like, these Etriads were the best dressed people in Europe. They wore fine European clothing. They had European furniture. They were, you know, they really did bring everything home and lived in a most astonishing way. And I think the thought that a boy from that sort of family could end up in Australia as convict with nothing, as a shepherd, when he's used to be the king of Orc, being reduced to a shepherd in the Australian bush, that really captured my heart, I think, you know, the thought of pride bleeding to a fall.
Yeah. So the amount of research that you did, it was a huge undertaking with some real highs and lows. Can you talk to us a little bit about that process?
Thank you. Thanks, Hayley. Yes, I made a list of these. I said I can never remember them off my head, but I'll try. Yes, the lows were a lot, because it was very hard until I was sure who he was to start with. And I was able, through a genealogist, to get a book about the family. And there were six brothers in this family, and he was the son of Nicolaus. Sorry, what was your question, Hayley? You'll think I'm nuts.
The researching process?
Yes, so I knew he was the son of Nicolaus. But apart from that, Edred did not give me much. It gave me everything in the way of atmosphere and of emotional pull, but it didn't give me any facts much. And so I knew if I wanted to pursue it further, and by this time I was obsessed. So I went off then to Malta. John came with me to Malta, and that was really profitable, because, as I say, the English had great reports, so I was able to read all about the trial, who the judges were. There were five men in the piracy sitting on the bench, and I knew who the man was who was defending him, and I knew who the prosecutor was. And so the whole trial procedure was there to be seen. That was wonderful. I wasn't able to find out what happened to their ship. That really interested me. Ships were an extremely valuable commodity, and I knew that the English, if they apprehended pirates, would treat them as a prize of war and would sell them. And the admiral gets so much, and the captain gets another percentage, and so it goes down. Every man in the crew gets a share of the prize. But I couldn't find any record of that. I thought, I don't like to give you any spoilers. You know, I keep a half of time, that's why I piss it out, because I think, oh no, that's a spoiler. But so in the end, though, I did find out, but totally through pure circumstance, way after I'd finished my research and had just given up on that. I was looking in something called the Niles Register, and the date was 1827, you know, as you do, wandering through 1827 magazine. And they caught my eye. And this was one of the biggest problems with my research, was the spelling. You know, how English people spelt Greek names. So Gikas was spelled with a G, with G-H, with a J, with a J-A-I. I think there's about 45 variants of his spelling alone. Then there's his last name. And the name of the ship was the Heracles, which thou word for Hercules. Well, I had looked every variant I could possibly think of. H-E-R, E-R, E-K, E-R-A-K, E-R-A-C, and so on. And in the end, this day that I was looking, this just caught my eye. A-K, I think. And so suddenly I thought, could that be it? And then when I read it, it was the auction of the ship, and it was talking about how much each, you know, how much the admiral got, how much the cap, got sought. So that was so exciting. You know, moments like that really, really just blew my mind. But, you know, that was a high. That wasn't one of the lows. I think the lows weren't really lows. They were just the ability to find what I wanted to find. And so I, but little bit by little bit, one of the biggest highs was when I was at Kew Archives, and I was there for 2 weeks. I stayed in a pub nearby and I walked every day, and you order the books you want and when all the documents, and when you come, they're in a locker and you put them on your trolley and you take them to your seat. Mine was 44B. And so I was sitting there at 44B. There's a girl here of 44A. I forget what she was researching. Anyway, I was looking and I got the captain's log of the ship, and that was so to actually touch the book that he had written me every day, the latitude and longitude, what sails he set, what the wind was. So I knew they were arrested on the 31st of July. And so, and there's, you know, of course he sell other voyages as well. So I had to find the right voyage that ship did. And so I'm turning over, thinking, oh my God, you know, them first, oh, what's happy on the page. And a couple of days before he started talking about, we've seen a strange sail in the distance and we set course to pursue it and it evaded us. And so for several days, they were playing cat and mouse just south of Crete. By this time, the boys were on their way home, so they were ill near Crete. And then on the 31st of July, boarded the stranger, and on board were 43 Greek pirates. And I'm thinking, 43? There's only 9. Everything says there were 9 there. Now they're talking about 43. And I'm thinking, have I got the right ship? Is there some mistake? Anyway, so I read on, and it's very interesting. I won't tell you what happened between when they were arrested and when they got to Malta, because it was quite an eventful trip. But then, so I had the ship's law, put them aside, the captain's law. Then I bought the ship's muster, and that's, you know, the named the people. So I had names of the captain, the crew, everything kept going. And there were 50 Turkish prisoners on this ship at the same time. They were in a little made-up enclosure that the ship's carpenter had made in the bow. So the 50 Turkish pirates were there, and then our boys, they made Barrett pay for them on the other side of the bow of the ship. And crikey, I lost my track again. Now I keep detouring off. It's a bit like going there rabbit warren for your research. Oh yeah, so I'm with the ship's muster. Sorry, I'm back there. And so I turn the ship's muster and I'm reading, you know, able seamen, such and such and such. And then I put page of Turkish prisoners, all their names. And then I came to the page with the Greek prisoners. Okay, please let them be on here. Please don't let them not be on here. Anyway, so down I went. Yes, there they were. And gonis humanovis, ikos bulgaris, all of them. I think that moment was probably, you know, that and discovering there were 43 of them, not 9, were probably the really high points of the whole thing. It was amused me, though, because there was one name missing from it. Damianos Ninas was one of the boys who ended up here. His name is not on that list, but there is a name called Franciscos Moustachios, as the Frank Moustache. And I thought, oh, but that's Damianos. You know, he tried to escape in Australia. He jumped on a ship, tried to get out. And he also made up stories for the newspaper at Sydney. And so I thought he was the one who would make up a name, I think. Yes, so there were lots of highs in the research and lots of serendipity.
Let me just say I'm slightly suspicious that, oh, we must go to Malta, John. Oh, maybe now we need to go queue for a couple of beers. So many of us are going to go home and look through our family tree for a group hire or two. So we can't talk about Son of Hydra without talking about Winter in Hydra. So this is a memoir, travel memoir that Shelley wrote that covers some of her time researching the boy's story. How did that come about? Did you know you were going to write that as part of the research process?
No, I didn't, Hayley. I had been, by that stage, I'd been working on Son of Hydra, this book. I've been working on it for 6 years. And I was finished and I had so many rejections from publishers that I thought, I just have to publish this myself. I'm too old. I haven't much time. I've got other books I want to write. Let's just publish it. But I didn't really know how to do it. So I thought, why don't I just write a little tiny book just to test the waters, to figure out how to upload, how to, you know. And I happened to have a diary from the time I went to Ypres to look for his story. And I had sold that to my Instagram customers. They paid $25 each. They came with me on the trip. And every night they got my diary and photos of the day. So I had all that. And so I thought it was only 20,000 words. So I had to double it and more. But I thought I could do that. That's a good idea. And also it's a curtain raiser for this. And so that was what I did. I did that and turned it in. And little knowing that that would turn into a little cyclone of its own, you know. So that was, it's a very happy circumspect. It's the nice, so.
As you were going through the research process, were you writing the story as well, or were they two completely separate phases of the project?
Do you know that the mists of time are a bit confused. I'm not actually sure. I think I'm pretty sure I decided when I was on Hydra looking for the story, I'm pretty sure at that stage I was thinking and I see it in Hydra in winter, and I said it to the fellow on the aeroplane that I was going to write a book, half joking. So I think I always thought there was a novel in it, but yes, it's so I was researching writing at the same time, Hayley, in fact, but a lot of it I couldn't write until I had the answers. Obviously, I couldn't write. I did write A Ship with No Men on It. Well, that was a vastly different story from 43 men, you know, on a much bigger ship than I. And when I had been in Hydra and Eleni in the archives, I'd say, I'm looking for a ship called Heracles. 9 boys were on it and they were arrested. And she has said, well, I can only find a way to head it, please. And she said, but it's quite a big ship. And I said, well, that probably wouldn't be it then, because these are just 9 teenagers at hijinks. And so when I found out then that there were 43 men, then it became much more obvious that that ship she had found, and they had amazing records of their ships, the Idiot Sue, the length, how many guns, what the wages were, what maintenance was done, you know, all their columns, like a spreadsheet. So, you know, that was amazing. But, yes, I was writing at the same time, to the extent that even last month, just as I was about to draw a line underneath the book, a vice admiral retired, a Hellenic Navy, contacted me, and he asked me, would I be able to give him some information, because he wanted to write a paper about these boys, because from the Greek perspective, they're freedom fighters. From the British perspective, they're pirates. And I believe they're somewhere in between the two, you know, but that's the different perspectives. And so, yes, the Greeks believing that he was a freedom fighter. Sorry, I've lost the plot a bit. This is a lesson in prevention.
I was thinking about my next question.
Hayley,
it's usual about you, next question.
Yes, you're not listening.
You were talking about Winter in Hydra. Winter? Hydra in Winter. Yeah. and how you got through to that process. But
Yes, it was just the story of my, and I didn't find out a lot, except it gave me great emotional pull. There were times on Idra when I felt as if I could channel, because I don't think you could ever write this book without having been to all the places that I went to, you know, to actually see the depth of a windowsill that's, you know, as wide as that, to see the windowsills, to see the light, to see the narrow hallways, the dock gears, the layout of the land, and to stand in the cell where he was held on Malta. That was, you know, I could, that was visceral. I could feel the claustrophobia just rising up and thinking, my God, imagine being in this cell for 2 years. How could you do that? And, you know, in Portsmouth to see where the hulks were moored, over in Swabs in the marshes where the clough, where the wood took a ferry over and the sandflies rose in clouds from these marshes, and he was on a hulk with 500 men. And that was also visceral to see that and think, my God, you know, this is where he was held.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that really comes across in both books is just that sense of place, the feeling, the smells, the feel of the winter. It's just everything's beautifully described. So with Son of Nidra, you've told the story it's Geeka's story. It's told through his voice. So he's a young Greek man. And forgive me for stating that, obviously, but obvious that you are not. How did you find his voice and why did you decide to tell it in the first person?
Actually, I always knew that was going to be very difficult. That was the big stumbling block, actually. I didn't dream for an instant that I would write it in the first person as I. I wouldn't presume to think I could put myself in the head of a young Greek boy. So originally I wrote in the third person as he did this, he did that. And that went on for, I would guess, 5 years like that. I wrote like that. And I just didn't feel I had him. I just wasn't happy with the person he was. And one day I was just sitting there despairing of it, thinking, I'll never be able to get in his head properly, Doc, convincingly. And I know this is spooky, but he just said to me, listen, you'll know be a real passion is, why don't you let me write it? And I just say, go ahead. And he took over. I feel as if, I mean, that's so ridiculous, Oda. But he just spoke out of my hands and suddenly it started to sink. Suddenly he was a real person. He became a real person and he developed all sorts of opinions that I had never given him. She died and he decided it was a love story. I knew Mary had to be in it, but he turned it into a love story. Yeah, so.
Sometimes you get a little angry with him or say you can't do that or you just let him go.
No, I just tend to let it go. Sometimes I had to say, listen, people know you stop bringing this boy, you're going to be such an arrogant jerk. You know, pull yourself back, buddy, because at the beginning people are going to like you enough to keep breathing. And sometimes, yes, it did get a bit too objectionable. And so then I would have to sort of go in and smoothen this, yes, and make him a little bit more lighter. And that was a very difficult thing to do, to strike that balance when you've got a hero who isn't really likable at the beginning, and yet you've got to paint the reader reading and they'll say, oh God, I can't bear this dirt, I won't read it. To strike that, then I hope I have, but it was a struggle a whole time. I can't tell you how many times I rewrote start of that book. Just so many talks trying to get that balance right.
I love doing these events because you really hear the honesty of the author's journey. So a 20-year process, 7 years of research, 5 years of writing, multiple rejections. So well done for getting him eventually setting sail. So we joke, can't we? So you also tell it with two timelines. So the narrative goes back and forth between his story in Australia and his youth on the island. Why did you decide to do it that way?
Originally, I didn't do it that way either. Originally, I started when he was a boy and I just went through the novel. But what happened was it would have had 15 iterations at least, maybe more. And I sort of think this book is too blokey. It's just too blokey. The whole first half is all blokes together. You know, and I bet you all mind readers, I imagine, are women almost, but not women. And so I put in a lot of chapters about his mother and his mother's relationship with the father, how they met, and I put in lots of, and the granny. I had more about the granny. But Seth just didn't marry. Barry kept calling to me. You know, she was the feminine part of this story. And call it geeker or bit geeker, so we fun. And so I thought, well, why don't I start when he arrives in New South Wales? So the love story with Mary can start right from the beginning. And if I'm clever, I can pull off going backwards and forwards in Tallinn. And that's always a risk, isn't it? Because as a reader, sometimes 1-3 pulls you and you just want to flick over the intermediary bits and go to the next. And so I did struggle with that a bit. And I hope, and they were like racehorses actually when I was doing this. You know, at one stage I think, oh, New South Wales is Voldemort. Eber's bore it as batch. And then I redrawned it a bit. Matter of fact, now Hedra's story, you know. So in the end, I hope I got them having it right. But even through the middle of it, I thought, this was still when I was trying to get something feminine into it. I split the book into two, and I had alternate chapters of Geeka's story and then my story of research. So my chapter would pose the research question that I couldn't find an answer to, and then the chapter in the book would answer that, you know, that I wouldn't find the answer in my chapter, but it would be somebody there. And that worked okay, but yes, it was when he said, I'll tell his story, that sort of, you know, that was the answer.
Mary's also a very strong, opinionated, I say headstrong character, and some of the terms Gundiaman and the insults that you use are fantastic. How meticulous were you with that research, getting the voice right, getting the clothing right, all of that type of thing?
Yes, for Gigas and Mary, the temptation and the perception would be that he would be an arrogant, fairly taciturn sort of a guy, and she would be a downtrodden servant. That would be the stereotypical perception. And I just thought, what if you put two really strong opinionate people together, a man who's come from a Greek society with the well-worn women, don't leave the house. And if they leave the house, they're well cut it, but chaperoned. Wonderful hostess, is very accomplished, but staying at home, being obedient, being virtuous, all the things that a Greek husband would want. How about putting him with someone really strong who's everything he doesn't want in a whore? But as soon as I thought that, I thought, well, of course, you know, you've got a bigger spark happening. But to sort of capture her, he wasn't so hard because I patterned him on the men I'd met on Edra, and I'd mushroom and I'd be his John and Bed and John's father. And you know, so men that I'd met throughout my life. For her, I did take particular notice in Ireland of the Irish girls, and I read everything I put about the Red Rovers because a lot of people in New South Wales weren't approving of bringing these girls in, these Irish girls who came from orphanages and workhouses, and it was perceived that they would bring their low morals into the colony and that they weren't suitable to end up as the buzz of, you know, the future New South Wales shit. And so, yes, to to actually have her defy that stereotype bit too. And I read a lot of other newspapers at the time and court cases where some of these Red Rover girls would get up in court and they would give the magistrate what for, you know, and really give it to them. And that made me realise that they weren't all downtrodden and silent. And so, yes, that's where Mary came from.
There's another one. Oh, now we have to go to Ireland for a month. This is a scam. I have to ask. So Mary is quick with an insult. What is a pratty dibble? I even Googled that.
Did you? Yes.
I'm sure I thought that bit. Haley just asked me, what is a pratty dibble? P-R-A-T-T-I-D-O-B-L-E. Isn't that amazing? See, that's stuck if you'll know. It's a bit of stick that when you're planting potatoes, you stick the stick in the ground and then you push the bit of the potato out. Yeah. So they're very skinny.
So I'm sure no one's ever heard that saying before, so that's how thorough her research was. So just on that, you'd uncovered as much as you could and it was time to start writing. Obviously, you had to be creative and fill in some of the blanks. So how did you reconcile that in your own mind? Like, how comfortable were you making up part of his story?
Yes. I really tried to keep to the facts totally. I would never say something that was patently untrue, except for a couple of things. There's seven guys on this second Greek voice came. And I included them all, and I got to know them all, and I got to love them all. And then last year, I sent the manuscript to a hugely talented editor in Melbourne, and she wrote back, among other things, and she said, seven men is just too many. You know, you just cannot, the reader just cannot keep their heads around that number of people to begin with. And so I had to cut two of them to make it five men instead of seven. And that was honestly by cutting off one of my lips. I was so fond of them by then. But I could understand that because it's really frustrating, isn't it? Where you just kind of, and there's enough people in it already for you to, especially jumping, for you to do that. The other thing was that when I decided to start it in New South Wales, when he arrives, I wanted the bromates to start then. I wanted them met then. And in fact, Mary didn't come for another 3 years. He had been in Australia. He was 1829. She was 1832. And I thought, I cannot just have that gap of 3 years. Otherwise, she'd be like coming at three quarters of the way. So I did do that. I had her arrive about the same time as he did. But apart from that, it's pretty well accurate, Hailing.
Fantastic. And he goes from a life of luxury and wealth to heartbreaking, a really backbreaking journey in Australia. So you really, I think, conveyed the hardships of life of the early settlers. Was this, uncovering all of this, was it an emotional journey for you?
Yes, it was emotional. I mean, when you're writing something like this, you have to resist the temptation to turn it into a book of horror. A, my mum wants to read book of horror. And B, you don't want to romanticise it either, because there's nothing romantic about having your ankles chained together. And nothing romantic about grubbing out suckers in a paddock, you know, with an apse or an adze. And I think having been a farm girl all our married lives, I had an understanding. I mean, I know what heartbreak is. And so I think that helped me stop from romanticising it, the whole thing, and give it just that bit of grit. A lot of it I had to imagine, like when they were on the hulk. But having been to Portsmouth and had he been shown over the victory by a vice admiral, who also told me, Vice Handels have got a thing from it. That's the second Vice Admiral. Anyway, I was shown over the victory via Vice Admiral, and hearing him talk about conditions on a hulk was very. So I tried to trip that line between romanticising it and between making it too horrible. And I work very hard on trying to get a balance in that, and so that you aren't repelled too much. And I tried to get relief. You know, after a particularly harrowing scene, I did try to have a light, happy scene in New South Wales.
Yeah. Digger starts out, as you said, he's pretty arrogant. He's fairly self-assured. And then, obviously, we're not giving anything away by saying he ends up in Australia. What do you think he learned on his journey?
Well, in my mind, it's very clear. I mean, what he actually learnt, you know, who knows? But to my mind, when he left home, he believed that wealth and power and status and name defined a man. That was the society he lived in. So he thought he needed those six to be a man. And it was, I thought, how amazing that you take someone like that, you strip every single vestige of power and wealth, everything away, and dignity, strip everything away from him. Dump him in a penal colony. What's he going to do? You know, where is he going to end up? And I like to think that he made that journey towards realizing that a man isn't measured by his money or his status or his will, but by how he treats others. And so that was the message I wanted to come out.
Lovely. I am worried we left him a little bit too early, and I have a lot of questions after the end of the book, you know, like, did he ever get back to the island? Did he reconcile with his father? So is there going to be a sequel, Shelley?
Well, I'll be able to write Dover at Court next as Mary's story, and she's got a great story in Ireland, and I had a wonderful, as you say, wonderful trip to Ireland, which was so...
It says it's horrible, like this, perfectly, it's in opposite settings.
Yeah, so, yes, I'm going to write Daughter at Court next, and that's her story. And I don't know whether I'll tell it in first person or third yet, but I think maybe first so it matches skills.
I have to wait.
So the first half will be her story in Ireland, but the second half will be the same story as his poem, except I imagine. And I don't know if I pull this off successfully until I get to it, but I imagine that her story is a very different story from his, you know, that they could talk each other, say, is it, when they were having an argument. So her version of it, you know, is going to be very different. And you hear Kizilis, so I can make that. And she, I've written half of it, and I just love her. She is just such fun to write, and so I will be forward to finishing that. I've always planned to write a third one about their life on an aero, because he did, although he didn't, obviously they all were orderly, well-mannered, very well-liked people, and he was well-liked in the district where he settled on the Bonaero. But there was a thing called the Robertson Land Act in the middle of the 1800s, where they were trying to get the land out of the hands of the rich landowners who had selected this land or had been given it at Nate's rates. So they were trying to give everyone's pass at land, and Vickers selected some land in the middle of a very powerful landowner's property, and there was quite a or a physical stout. Well, you know, this is what will happen if I arrive it. But there's I think it could be quite the interesting story, but I haven't researched that at all. So, you know, that will evolve another residency. So
thanks everyone for coming, and you'll be hanging around for a while to answer some more questions. Thanks, Sirioji Mom.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2025-26 Summer Mesklun. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, Remember to slip, slop, slap this summer and keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.